From the newsrooms of WBUR and GBH, I'm Carrie Young. Welcome to Consider This in Boston, where a pivotal landmark in the city's civil rights movement faces demolition. The Freedom House in Roxbury was referred to by some as the Black Pentagon, and it served as a key meeting place that helped spur desegregation in Boston schools and the fight for racial equity across the city, among many other things. Reporter Tori Bedford dug deep into the history of this space and talked to the people who are trying to save the old building from destruction. And she joins us now. Hey, Tori, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so first, why don't you tell us a little bit more about the Freedom House?
So this is such a significant space, and it has been for a really long time. Otto and Muriel Snowden, they were award-winning social workers. They bought the original brick building. Actually, it's not the original, but it's the oldest space and the longest space that they had on Crawford Street in 1952. That's where they hosted these massive receptions for civil rights figures like Martin Luther King Jr. Leaders from NAACP chapters across the country would come. Boston changemakers were always there, like Melnea Cass. President John F. Kennedy visited. Northeastern University did an archives project in 2008 where they interviewed Barbara Lomax Dawson, who is a former employee at the Freedom House, who I think summed it up really perfectly.
Freedom House made an invaluable, undeniable, deep, deep, deep impression and effect. Freedom House is just there. It's, you know, it's a given.
And so most of us are familiar with the busing crisis in the 70s and 80s. Black children were bused into white school districts and racial unrest rocked the city. Decades before that, social workers from the Freedom House were organizing freedom schools, which is they were places for Black children to receive an education that they were being refused in white schools. And, you know, they put together standouts and protests to counter racism and segregation in schools. It was also a safe place where Black people could have a wedding or a funeral, right? And with segregation, not everyone would provide that. They had vigils where hundreds gathered, you know, for people lost to racial injustice, police violence. There was a massive effort to socially integrate the Jewish and Black communities in the Grove Hall neighborhood. And they just did, I don't know, they just kind of built this foundation where there was so much work done there to create kind of a racial unity across the city and fight for civil rights.
Wow, there really is so much rich history there, it sounds like. But what happened between now and then? I mean, and what goes on at the Freedom House now these days?
So after the Snowdens died, the building actually started to slip into disrepair in the 90s. You know, there's just flooding. You can go in and look kind of in the windows now. Paint is just peeling. There's several floors, like the flooding has affected them in the mold. It's in such bad disrepair. It would require massive renovations, and it has for a long time. So in 2010, the Freedom House organization received a $1 million matching grant from the state to fix up that old building and renovate an old library across the street. And that's where the organization works now. It was supposed to be temporary, but they're actually finding that they can really do a lot of the great work that they need to do out of that place. So as a foundation, they mainly focus now on academic, social, employment, cultural programs for young people who are heading to college or currently enrolled. You know, a lot of students work there. They take classes. They volunteer. Executive Director Katrina Shaw told me that they held on to that old building, though. I mean, out of huge financial loss, repeatedly making appeals to raise money for renovations and trying desperately to save the space just as it continued to deteriorate.
People weren't giving. People didn't want to give. People loved the idea of Freedom House and what it meant to the city, but no one would really put their financial wherewithal behind it.
And this went on for a decade, but it just wasn't working. So last year, the foundation sold the old building to a developer for $1.5 million.
Okay, so what happens now with the building?
So the plan now is to demolish that old building and construct mixed-income housing there, apartments where, you know, hopefully people who work at the Freedom House but can't afford to live in Boston because of these crazy rental prices, they could actually live in that building. And they also want to honor that original building and that old space with a memorial on the site. And so Shaw, I mean, is bittersweet. She's really heartbroken. I think she said to me, like, if somebody wanted to give me $20 million today, like, I would absolutely renovate that space. This is not her first choice. But she kind of feels resigned as well. She feels like the mission of the place still continues in the new building. She's happy to have the money to put towards their programs now in the new building. And when I was there speaking with her, you know, you could see some of these traditions from the older building carry on there now. Like there was a luncheon with the Golden Heirs of Freedom House, which is a program for seniors run by Jumada Abdal Khalak Henry Smith, who used to go to Golden Heir meetings with her mother in the old building.
I hate to see the loss of something the historical, because like my mom was breathing in there and all those other Golden Heirs, you know, they met and it was just a wonderful experience. You know, there's something about being able to hold on and for your children's children to see it.
So you wrote in your piece that they plan to break ground on this in 2023, and things are already moving forward, but some people are starting to speak up now and ask if it's maybe not too late to save the old building.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's surrounded by all these other landmarks, right? Like there's the house where Malcolm X spent a lot of his youth, structures from the Revolutionary War. There's homes of English settlers and church deacons. It's one of a handful of landmarks from the civil rights era that remains in Boston. And it's a symbol of the fight for equal rights that, you know, it could soon disappear. Christopher Martell, who's a UMass professor who lives in Dorchester, he teaches his students about Boston's educational history through a tour that begins at the old Freedom House, which was an important nerve center during the violent reaction to school desegregation.
It tells a much longer story than just Boston busing, that really there was a fight for racial integration in schools decades before that. And it's one of the few structures, I think, from the civil rights era really left in Boston.
Martell actually wrote a letter to the Boston Landmarks Commission, and shortly after his letter, the Landmarks Commission received another application to delay the demolition, and they classified the Freedom House, tentatively, I guess. I mean, there's a process, but they classified it as historically significant.
Oh, wow. So that sounds like progress, at least, right?
Yes. I mean, here's the next steps. They're working towards a delay of the demolition. Even if there is a 90-day delay, it doesn't mean that the demolition won't happen. Ultimately, I think, you know, alternatives would have to be found that would provide a reasonable solution, right? Because this is kind of after 10 years, like they've come to this point and they're like, this is the best we can do. So this will be interesting to see what's presented. There's got to be a public meeting to be held to discuss those alternatives to demolition. And then the Landmarks Commission can hold their own public hearing, and then they can potentially place a 90-day delay on the demolition. And so that kind of gives a little bit of, it shines a light on this issue, and it also gives people a little bit of time to potentially figure something out.
Well, this is definitely something we'll be keeping an eye on over the next few months to see what unfolds. Thanks, Tori, for bringing us this story and really highlighting this history.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's GBH reporter Tori Bedford. Before we go, I should tell you what else is happening. As the number of new COVID cases continues to surge in Massachusetts, public health experts say they don't know how bad it's going to get. Dr. Paul Bittinger of Mass General Brigham is a member of the state's COVID Medical Advisory Committee, and he says in South Africa, cases of the Omicron variant dropped off rapidly after an astronomical rise.
That's obviously what we're hoping here, is that the numbers start falling quickly, but I don't think yet we have a sense for when the peak is going to come and how high it's going to be. And our big concern is the more people that are infected, some percentage of them will need to be hospitalized, and that's into a system that is extraordinarily strained right now.
Some believe the already high numbers reported here are still way less than the number of actual infections. Meanwhile, experts are looking at wastewater measurements to get a better handle on the latest wave of the virus. Their estimates suggest that there's 10 times more COVID in the state's wastewater than at any other point in the pandemic. Jeremy Lubin is with the UMass Medical School and the Massachusetts Consortium on Pathogen Readiness.
There's just huge amounts of virus in the communities that's circulating, and it's not necessarily reflected in the test positivity.
With all of that in mind, some Beacon Hill legislators are trying to improve access to COVID tests, which have gotten pretty scarce in the latest wave. Senator Joe Comerford wants answers from the Baker administration on why Massachusetts hasn't done more to ramp up testing.
The question is whether or not the Baker administration and the governor himself was willing to pivot, to do what these public health researchers and academics have been saying that we should do, which is meet this dynamic pandemic stage by stage, doggedly, by ebbing and flowing our resources and policy responses as needed.
The Baker administration has blamed difficulties getting COVID tests on high demand after holiday gatherings and travel. Well, that's all we've got for today. From the newsrooms of WBUR and GBH, Boston's dynamic duo of public broadcasting, I'm Carrie Young. Hey, you're a podcast listener, obviously. Would you like this show along with all of WBUR's best news stories of the day about Boston and the region, all in a podcast feed? I suggest you search WBUR News in your podcast app and hit subscribe. You'll be able to find just the local segment of Consider This, plus our best coverage in business, tech, politics, education, and arts coverage, all in one place. Search WBUR News in your podcast app and hit subscribe.